Blog Talk Radio.
And that is my cue. Welcome, everyone. You are listening to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm Greg Masters, known to some on Twitter as 2HealthGuru. And I am trying to stop the music. This is always fun. You just got to love these cloud services. They're so responsive in real time. I'm Greg Masters, known to some on Twitter as 2HealthGuru, the producer and co-host of this broadcast, and I'm joined, as always, by my partner and co-host, Dr. Pat Salver, also known on Twitter as @DocWeighsIn. Hello, Pat.
Well, hello, Greg. And usually I say I'm online from beautiful, sunny California, Northern California, but today it's beautiful, rainy Northern California.
Well, you guys have a lot of trees up there. They have to drink, right?
They do.
So let me tell you that This Week in Health Innovation is brought to you by healthinnovationmedia.com. Do check us out on the web as we follow the emerging digital health ecosystem from idea to business model. And we have another timely installment in this continuing interview series with thought leaders and disruptive voices driving transformation of legacy American healthcare. Our special guest today is Farzad Mostashari, MD, visiting fellow of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution and former national coordinator for health information technology at the Department of Health and Human Services. According to welcome.
Hi, Farzad.
So let me just
enough intro, Greg.
Plug.
Enough intro.
Enough intro. Okay, Pat, over to you. Introduce us to Farzad, at least for those who don't know him.
I know. Greg could just go on and on and on. What can I say? So, Farzad, I'm really excited to have you here today. And I don't know if you know how much buzz there was when you announced that you were leaving OMC, and it was, what's Farzad going to do next? What do you think he's going to end up? And then when we heard it was the Engelberg Center, it was like, wow, that's really cool. So tell us, what exactly are you doing and are going to be doing at Brookings?
So it's a really great place. And the two things I'm most excited about at Brookings is the payment reform work that they're doing. So there was just a letter we sent to the Senate Finance Committee and House Ways and Means about the payment reform for physicians, the so-called sustainable growth rate or SGR doc fix. And there was an event yesterday with Representative Burgess and others where, as part of that panel, it's actually, I just tweeted about it, the video's up on YouTube, I interviewed Mark Wager from Heritage Provider Network about independent practices and payment reform. What are the opportunities and challenges for them? So that's one end of what I'm doing is being able to dig into the finance part, the payment reform part of healthcare, which is so important. It provides that context for everything else that happens in the delivery of healthcare, including the technology pieces, as you know. The second part of what I'm doing is focusing on those small practices. Kind of, I feel like a little bit going back home to what I was doing in New York City, helping small practices change their workflows and do kind of IT-enabled population health management. Well, it's very familiar because these accountable care organizations across the country, particularly the physician ones that aren't affiliated with a hospital, they have a big job in front of them to be able to reduce healthcare costs while improving quality. And it's has everything to do with IT-enabled population health management, patient engagement, care coordination. So I'm setting up an innovation exchange for these small physician ACOs. Separately, I've also put out an offer there on Twitter to an under-resourced accountable physician ACO who would like my consulting services if they're within commuting distance of Bethesda. So those are the variety of things I'm working in, but it all kind of fits together in terms of changing how we pay for care and how care is delivered, but this time from the implementation side rather than the policy side.
Well, that sounds really interesting, and I think what I'd like to do is to start by diving into this whole issue of small practices and what
yes.
their future is and how they are going to fit into the overall healthcare system, given that a lot of the ACOs are big organizations, right? They're not the
mm-hmm.
small organizations.
That's
Tell
right.
Tell me how you see, I mean, I guess, is there life for these small practices after
yeah.
after ACOs get implemented?
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the questions I asked Mark Wager was, are independent practices going the way of the dodo? Should we still be worried about independent practices? Aren't they all being bought out by hospitals anyway? Why even work on that? The perspective, I think, is first influenced by data. The American Medical Association just put out a pretty well-done survey that compared who physicians work for in 2012-13 compared to 2007-08. And what they found was that there had been an 8 percentage point shift in hospital ownership of physician practices, which is a lot, but hospital-owned practices were only still 15.6% of all physicians worked directly for a hospital. Another 25% were in affiliate networks of hospitals, but 60% of physicians still work for physicians, and many of them work for themselves. So the rumors, the reports of the death of the independent practices, I think, are much exaggerated. The other point that Mark Wager, who's been through this before, brought up is, you know, we've kind of seen this movie once before where hospitals bought up practices, their productivity plummeted, they didn't see the returns on investment, and particularly if some of these payment differentials between, you know, inpatient hospital side of service and outpatient side of service, those are narrowed down, that arbitrage opportunity goes away. We could see practices go back and hospitals, that pendulum shift back again. So I guess the first part of your question is there a future for independent practice of medicine in America? I think yes, but they need tools, new tools and probably new services to help them be able to stay independent financially, but be part of coordinated networks of care, which is really the bottom line.
So are we talking about virtual, larger medical groups? I have my independent practice in a small town,
yeah.
but I'm not really just practicing in my four walls. I'm a part of a larger world.
That's right. I think there are a lot of IPAs who are doing this. I was speaking to a group in Tempe, Arizona, and they started a physician ACO with 30 primary care providers, now up to 80 primary care providers. And they're on different electronic health record systems. They have they charge fee for service separately, but they're in one accountable care organization. They have they're going to be having a consistent set of protocols. They're going to have consistent referral patterns. They're going to have some services to help them case manage their highest risk patients, for example. Those are some of the new forms of kind of virtual integrated networks that I think are really exciting to think about. And really, technology is what is, I think, enabling this sort of disruption where you can see independent practices work in a coordinated manner.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking earlier, Greg and I, about One Medical, which has just partnered with Google in the new Google Help
mm-hmm.
Apps. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but
mm-hmm.
I looked at that and I said, wow, so if I'm in a one or two person practice and I can't really afford to support a care coordinator or a healthcare coach or whatever, I could actually share that with other people, no matter where they were, via something like a Google Help out or Skype
That's
calls
right.
or you know
That's
who,
right.
who knows what. Are you starting
right.
to see that actually happen, or is that still just people like you and me smoking something.
No, I think we are seeing actually physician ACOs outnumber hospital ACOs by a fair margin, and they're the only ones where the growth is coming on the side. You know, ACOs can be a really great vehicle for hospitals to bridge the gap between our current payment systems and the future payment systems, but they may actually be the ideal payment system for primary care providers, where there is a floor of fee-for-service, and then added on top of that, incentives and resources for them to manage care better and be able to share in part of those savings. So I think that those models can be highly successful. And one of the things that's interesting about the whole ACO concept and by the different players is if you're a hospital, and many of the hospital ACOs talk about the challenge of dealing with so-called, you've heard this word before, demand destruction. If we really get really good at managing patients and chronic disease management and prevention and on the outpatient side, we reduce the admissions, we reduce the cost of care, but that was our admission. That was our income. So
heads in bed.
Right. So it's as they do this transition from volume to value, they're in a tough spot. The physician ACOs have no problem at all with that because the demand that they're reducing is not for their services. It's for someone else's services. They can really afford to invest without concern in those in that chronic disease management care coordination, et cetera.
And so this is really interesting with respect to the hospitals because that it's always been a question in my mind. When we really get efficient, what is the hospital of the future going to look like? What would you say if you were giving a talk in front of a bunch of hospital CEOs? How should they be preparing for a future where we're all aiming to have use fewer and fewer of their services?
Hospitals have to decide who they're going to be and what their business model is going to be. And I think there are going to be some hospitals that focus on becoming factories, very efficient factories at producing very high quality and consistent outcomes, say for knee replacements, hip replacements, cardiac procedures, and so forth. I think those are going to be highly successful. There are others who are going to move up, and they're going to be highly specialized places you go where the world's greatest experts and people from all over the world are going to come for this very specialized knowledge and the people and the specialists that you can get nowhere else. And they're going to do fine if they can happen to be have that sort of brand. And there'll be a few quaternary centers in that camp. Everybody else is going to have to figure out how to balance those two parts of their business. And fundamentally, I think a lot of hospitals, particularly in areas where there's an oversupply of beds, are going to have to cut costs. They're going to have to be able to be survive in a world where there are fewer admissions. And in a sense, as Thomas Friedman said, flip the hospital. Instead of focusing more on what happens in the hospital and afterwards, flip it to being more involved with the care of the patient in the community and before the admission.
And as I think about
easy transition to make.
No, I mean, that's the problem is I think the hospitals are going to have the most difficult of all transitions, which is why when you talked about what on earth are the hospitals doing buying up practices again? I mean, we saw that when they first started doing it. I said, ooh, weren't they paying attention last time? Actual fact, it is a way of them ensuring that they continue to have, a source of referrals into their beds. Less viable business model, could you see a day when, particularly in the rural areas where, you know, some of these hospitals are, maybe 20-bed hospitals, you know, small hospitals, not necessarily able to support a full range of services, would we be better off thinking about having a bunch of freestanding ERs in all of these smaller areas, and then just a really darn good way of transporting people who need to be hospitalized into into more central regions? Do you think that there will come a day where that becomes a model that might be viable?
I don't know. I think the key is going to be finding the most efficient, highest quality, lowest cost way of delivering care in various settings. And what's really interesting, I was talking to this physician, ACO, and they were talking about having a place for patients to go after hours and about how they might do a partnership with one of these convenience clinic chains, right? So whereas before, the primary care docs didn't want their patients to go to these minute clinic type of settings, now they want to have that relationship and say, if it's after hours, go there instead of going to the emergency room, and we'll be sure that you have to get right in, we have a special thing, and yes, coordination, and we'll get the records, right? So getting those sort of or setting up their own urgent care centers. So finding the right setting of care that provides the most cost-effective care, the most coordinated care, the lowest cost is going to be, I think, a winner.
So let's talk a little bit about payment reform. There are a lot of people, so we've already decided that we can't pronounce the small practices dead. Can we pronounce fee-for-service dead? Occasionally you'll read headlines that say it's going where the dodo went. What do you think about that?
I'm sorry. I missed your question. Say that again.
The question is there a future for fee-for-service, or are we going to see it go the way the dodo went?
I think there is. Look, there are some things that it just makes sense to – it's really going to be too hard to only pay for outcomes. There are going to be some things where it makes sense to pay it by the piece. Those pieces might get bigger, right? So you may see more bundles, which is like a DRG, right? That's fee for service, but it's also a bundle, right? And you might see those bundles getting bigger. So I think you'll see – modifications to fee-for-service. I don't think every provider is going to be fully capitated, prepay option. I think there are advantages for some sort of payment to be that way. But increasingly, I think there'll be layered on to that fee-for-service value bonuses and quality bonuses. There'll be larger bundles. There'll be shared savings on top of that. So the general move is going to be, whereas I was at one hospital who said that there are $15 million total at risk for quality out of over $1 billion in annual revenue, well, that's not going to be $15 million. It's not going to be, less than 1% of their earnings. It's going to be upward of 10% pretty soon, or 20% or 30% for providers that have, margins of 2.5-3%. So it's going to be, I think we're going to see modifications to fee-for-service. We're not just going to see, it going extinct, and it's going to be layered on. My best guess.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. So much experimentation going on now, which is really exciting, and physician-led experimentation, which I think is even more exciting. And one of those experiments that looks like it's gotten pretty good legs is direct primary care. How do you see that fitting into everything?
Direct primary care is really interesting because it lets providers with relatively modest per patient kind of a concierge-like fee or something, add-on fee, right? For them to have a huge difference in their bottom line and for them to be able to add services that you otherwise aren't paid for under fee-for-service. So to be able to offer longer visits, same-day scheduling, open clinics, email with the doc, and more, right? And what's neat about it is under an accountable care structure that where you want to save costs, those are exactly the things you do anyway, right? But it's giving the patient an even better experience. It's giving them a platinum experience, right? And saying to the patient, hey, for this platinum experience, would you pay $100 extra a month for them? It's a pretty neat model. And in combination with health savings accounts and high deductible plans, it can actually make a lot of sense for the patient to be able to use their health savings account, use that deductible, and to get this higher level of service. The one kind of, I guess, small point to raise, though, about the future of what primary care is going to look like in America, and I think it's an open question. My friend Rajika Fernandopoulou would say, you can't make a car fly by tacking on wings to it, by which I think he means you have to fundamentally rewrite, scrap the old clinic, scrap the old model, and start fresh with a completely new design of everything, including your billing. Not worrying about fee-for-service billing at all, not worrying about E&M at all, not worrying about, right, totally new model of care. There's others who say, yes, that's wonderful where that works, and increasingly we hope there'll be more and more clinics like that, but there's two issues. One is typically those providers see fewer patients, have a smaller cohort of patients that they manage, and aren't you going to face a primary care shortage if everybody did that? And two, the concern is how long is it going to take to take every practice and, wait for the doc to retire or to wait for them to, basically quit their practice and join a completely new model of care. Can't we layer on? People are hurting today. Can't we layer on some capabilities to existing fee-for-service practices, which I think is, I think we need both. I think we need to be pragmatic and visionary and aspirational at the same time, kind of the old eye on the prize, feet on the ground.
Yeah, there's another issue here, too. You brought up the primary care shortage issue, and I have an intern who works with me who's pre-med, and we talk all the time about what's facing young people as they go to medical school and have to make their decisions of where to practice. And, with the financial burden that they come out of college and medical school and residency with, it really makes it very difficult for them to pick primary care. And that's one thing. And then the other issue is, the hamster model is just plain not very appealing. So as we have to redo everything, it's not just redoing the practices, but redoing our approach to medical education and probably training people more in teams now as opposed to the way that that you and I were trained.
Well, let's do some math. I did this math for a group of venture capitalists at a conference in Boston. The primary care provider makes, on average, I think, $170,000 a year in the U.S. It's less for pediatricians. They have 2,000 patients, say, on average. Some have 2,500, some have 1,500. Say 2,000. And each of those patients, the per capita costs are, say, $5,000 to $8,000 a year. Let's say $5,000 a year. That's $10 million of healthcare spend for that primary care provider. The primary care provider only accounts for 3% of that, right? But they are the single most influential person in influencing that total spend. Where the person goes to see the referral, what specialist they go to, what hospital they get admitted to, whether they need a hospitalization at all. Right, they don't have full control. No one has full control, but they have more control than anybody else. And currently, they don't make an extra dime if they really work hard to coordinate the care for that patient and to achieve the best outcomes at the lowest cost for that patient. If they did, if they were in an accountable care organization structure and they could save 5% of the cost for those patients, that and they got to keep half of it, that would double their income. That would double their revenue. So you would see not a 10% bump for primary care under a fee-for-service model. You could potentially see a primary care doc making $350,000 a year. Now, that would be
and if
a
you pay them,
doc,
they will
could,
come.
Yeah, and they would want their kids to go into primary care. And they would be off the hamster wheel because it's not the only way to make more money would be to squeeze in more and more patients in less and less time and complain about how, don't slow me down. Don't slow me down, EHR, by asking me if, you know, they've filled their prescription or not. Don't slow me down by pointing out that, you know, their blood pressure is not under control. Don't slow me down, right? That's the fundamental problem that we have is the hamster wheel that comes from the fee-for-service system for primary care, and yet they hold the key to the kingdom. They don't even know it.
Yeah, and actually in some ways they should be the kings and the queens because, as you said, they have the opportunity to influence the health of populations, right? And and essentially control the whole way that the money flows. So
that's
instead
right.
of people saying, oh, that's the last thing I ever want to do, it should really be the first thing people want to
that's
do.
Right.
And I hope
and
that
And they're selling their practices to hospitals because they feel overwhelmed and, you know, unable to manage that transition.
Yeah. So, well, this is great fun, and we could go on forever, but we only have 5 minutes left.
Isn't it?
I wanted to ask you to reflect on your time at ONC. We all loved having you at ONC, and I think you know from the tributes that you got when you left how appreciated you were. Can you tell us what were some of the highlights of your time there?
Yeah. I mean, look, it was an amazing experience for me, both because of the wonderful people at ONC, the amazing civil servants, public servants who – you know, don't get a lot of acknowledgement in our country these days, but really were so so smart, so hardworking, so committed, and the opportunity to lead them, but also the opportunity to feel like the representative of a broader health IT community of all the, you know, the developers and the innovators and the delivery system folks and the nurses and doctors who are implementing and the patients and the patient advocates. So it really was an amazing time, and I guess connecting that to what I'm focused on now and what the country really needs now was the idea that you could not succeed at this before because people didn't have the data to manage care instead of just gatekeeping care. And that, I think, is the what gives me hope that this time is different.
Yeah, you know, it's so amazing. I was working for General Motors.
I may be cut off. I apologize. If I am, I guess the side.
Oh, well, why don't we wrap it up then, because we don't want to cut you off or me off mid-sentence. It's really been wonderful having you here. We'd love to have you come back and maybe continue the conversation at some time in the near future. And meanwhile, I really want to congratulate you on what you did at ONC, and I'm looking forward to seeing all of the great things that come out of Brookings as a result of your affiliation. Thanks, Farzad.
Thank you so much. I'd be happy to do this again.
And that'll be the last word. Thank you so much, Farzad, for your time today. Unfortunately, we did not get the disclosure of who's behind Farzad's bow tie. I guess we'll leave that to a follow-up edition on This Week in Health Innovation. This is Greg Masters saying thank you for listening, and join us next week on another edition of This Week in Health Innovation. Bye now.
Greg?